Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Coming up on the program today, conservative Hans Bader says we the people should not be overlooking corporate bookkeeping. Cosmic comic Swami Beyond Ananda is going to be dropping by later on in the program. Also, is Homeland Security preparing for martial law and detention center camps here in the United States? Or should we take off our tinfoil hats? Where does one begin and the other end? Hans Bader is with us right now with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website. Hans, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I understand you're one of the attorneys who have filed a lawsuit in federal district court challenging the constitutionality of, is there a way to pronounce this acronym, PCAOB?
Well, people call it the peekaboo as sort of a nickname.
Okay.
Technically, you can only call it the PCAOB, which doesn't roll off the tongue very well.
Right. Well, it's the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. Now, this was created in 2002 as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley piece of legislation. And the Sarbanes-Oxley was passed by a 99-0 vote in the Senate and a 423-3 vote in the House. And I'm wondering, and oddly, Sarbanes-Oxley does not contain severability. Most bills have what's called severability built into them. In other words, if some part of the bill is struck down as being unconstitutional, illegal, inappropriate, whatever, then the rest of the bill stays in place. That part that gets knocked down is severed from the bill. But Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't contain that. So if you're successful in knocking this piece out of Sarbanes-Oxley, you're going to wipe out this entire protection that we the people have from corporations basically pulling an Enron on us. Why are you doing this?
Well, this law doesn't do anything about Enron. Frankly, this law benefited the big accounting firms that were responsible for failing to warn the public about Enron and WorldCom.
How so?
Sarbanes-Oxley set up this board, the peekaboo, that has issued hundreds of pages of red tape that have created tons of new work for the very big accounting firms that failed to detect the looming Enron and WorldCom bankruptcies. In fact, both Enron and WorldCom had lots of fancy accountants, and they had a clean bill of health, clean financial reports, just before they went bankrupt.
Well, that's because they were internally doing their own stuff. I mean, Sarbanes-Oxley, here are the major provisions. It requires certification of financial reports by the CEO. In other words, now the guy who's in charge is putting his butt on the line. It bans personal loans to the executive director or officers.
Although they can give personal grants, and now they're just turning the loans into outright gifts.
Okay. It accelerates the reporting of trades by insiders. I would think that investors would want to know that. It prohibits insider trades during pension fund blackout periods. There's a republic reporting of CEO and CFO compensation and profits.
Fine. These are all fine, but the problem is...
But these are all going to go away if you're successful.
Well... Some of their
it also provides for criminal and civil penalties for violations of the securities law, which weren't there before, and longer jail sentences and larger fines for executives who knowingly and willfully misstate financial statements. I mean, you call it red tape and extra work for the accountants. I'd call it keeping these people accountable.
Well, the judge isn't necessarily going to throw the whole thing out. Just because you do not have a severability clause in the law, it doesn't mean that any challenge that succeeds necessarily kills the whole law. It does sometimes mean that the whole law is killed if you throw out a central portion of it. I suppose people could agree or disagree about whether the board created by it is sufficiently central that you throw the whole thing out. That's not my interest. My interest in getting in this case was to ensure accountability by making sure that this board has some degree of accountability to the people's elected representatives, the president by having the president appoint them, and the Senate by having the Senate confirm them.
Now, this is one of the interesting...
Whether the law goes down the tubes is not really that important to me personally.
Yeah, this was one of the things that I thought was interesting, Hans Bader. In your lawsuit, you suggest that this board is really not legal because it's not properly, that it's not constitutional.
Right.
Because it's not properly appointed. Can you direct me, I'm sitting here with a copy of the Constitution in my hand, to that part of the Constitution that you think this violates?
It's the Appointments Clause of the Constitution.
And where is that found?
It's in Article 2, dealing with the president's
with the executive branch.
Right. If you look at that, it says that the Do you have a second? I hate to admit this.
I do. I've got yeah, and I've got it right here.
My issue.
Because I read it this morning, and you know, and I read all of Article 2, and I know that there is, you know, it talks about the appointment of officers. It talks about the appointment of senior officials, but I just don't see how it would, you know, what that has to do with Sarbanes-Oxley.
Well, the board.
You know, take a second and find it if you need.
Right, the board is a governmental entity because its members are appointed by government officials, the SEC commissioners as a whole. It enforces federal laws. In fact, if you violate its rules, you can be criminally prosecuted. It gets its funding from a federal source, a accounting support fee, which is described in a law passed by Congress and payment mandated by Act of Congress.
Right.
So it is a governmental agency. And once you show that it's a governmental agency, then they're officers of the United States, and they have to be appointed in the manner that the Appointments Clause mandates. The Appointments Clause provides that the President, quote, shall nominate and, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein provided for, but Congress may, by law, vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments.
Right, you're drawing, number one, the President has supported this, so the President is supportive of that. And secondly, you're drawing a mighty broad stroke there. I mean, if we were to take your logic and extend it all the way out, then the President should have to be the guy who appoints the local Parks and Garden Commission here in Portland, Oregon.
No, not all low-level government employees, like the janitor, are deemed officers of the United States, because you have to have some significant authority under Supreme Court case law to be an officer of the United States. So the janitor doesn't have to be picked in accordance with the Appointments Clause.
No, but the guy who's in charge of the park...
If you're an inferior officer, you can be picked by the head of a department. So the head of a department can be, say, you know, the Department of Labor, it can be the Secretary of Labor, Department of the Interior, Secretary of the Interior. So you can be picked by the head of the department rather than the president if you're an inferior officer.
Right.
And if you're important enough, you're a big major policymaker and you've got a lot of power, then you have to be picked by the president.
But you're suggesting then that these should be essentially cabinet positions because, for example, the president, correct me if I'm mistaken, the president, for example, did not pick the subsidiaries to the cabinet officers. For example, he didn't pick Brownie to be heading FEMA because FEMA was no longer a cabinet office. It was under Homeland Security. So Chertoff picked Brownie.
Right.
Is that right? Okay,
well,
so this is Sarbanes-Oxley is like way low from a cabinet office.
Well, if you take the position that they're inferior officers, they still had to be picked by the head of a department, and they weren't. They were picked by the SEC commissioners as a whole, rather than the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, who's got administrative and managerial powers the other guys lack, and who is not just a nominal head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, but its real head. You've got to be picked by the head of a department, even if you're just an inferior officer. They weren't picked by the head of the SEC. They were picked by the members acting collectively.
But that's how the law was written.
Right, and Alexander Hamilton, explaining the meaning of the Appointments Clause in Federalist Number 76, said when they say head of department, it means one single man. So it's the SEC's chairman who'd have to pick them.
Okay, so you may have an argument here that, albeit somewhat technical, could bring down this piece of Sarbanes-Oxley and conceivably could bring down all of Sarbanes-Oxley. It again raises the question, why? I suspect that you're not there over there at the Competitive Enterprise Institute just sitting around saying, you know, where might there be some little violation of the Constitution we should jump on? Really what you guys want to do is bring down the ability of we the people through our government that we own and that is operated by people that we elect to represent us to oversee the activities of corporations in America, is it not?
No. But what I'm trying to do is make sure that this board is subject to we the people by having its budget set by Congress, by having its members confirmed by Congress through the Senate, and by having the President appoint them so that there's some degree of accountability.
But wouldn't that also politicize it?
Sorry?
Wouldn't that also politicize it? Wouldn't that also put it in a position where, you know, Tom DeLay, if you guys give him enough money, could come along and say, hey, we're going to cut their budget in half?
Well, they're already politicized in the sense of being responsible to the big players. I mean, if they tick off the big accounting firms who they've enriched enormously by issuing hundreds of pages of red tape creating the need for more complicated audits, if they piss off the big accounting firms, those big accounting firms will go to Capitol Hill with their fancy lobbyists and potentially get some law that changes or curtails a little bit the board's power. It's only the little people who are powerless in that sense. So they only have a recourse through the ballot box or whether they vote or don't vote for the president, who does care what the public thinks, because, you know, Bush was only reelected by about a 2 or 3 point margin.
You really think Bush cares what the people thinks?
I think he cares more than the
Accounting
Oversight Board cares.
Yeah.
But I think it also helps in even-handed application of the law, because if you look at the way the board has behaved, it's been awfully easy on the big accounting firms that it's made rich. It hasn't seriously disciplined them at all, even though its inspection reports have found that they've had multiple violations of its rules. At the meantime, it has disciplined little accounting firms who are not beneficiaries of its rules and regulations because they can't provide the kind of incredibly fancy audits that you have to do.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, you know, typically CEI is here defending the big corporations. Here you're defending the small guys. If that's the case, I congratulate you.
Small guys are important. Small guys provide services that small public companies, you know, development stage companies and microcaps need. They can't afford the services of a big accounting firm.
But my sense is there's something more to this, but maybe not. Hans Bader, thanks for making your case here on our program.
Thank you.
Good speaking with you. CEI.org for more information. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, there's many a strange impulse out on the plains of West Texas.
A strange impulse.
There's many a young boy who feels things he can't comprehend.
Uh-oh.
And a small town don't like it when somebody falls between sexes. Oh, a small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men.
That's Willie Nelson.
And I believe to my soul that inside every man there's the feminine. And inside every lady there's the deep, manly voice, loud and clear. Well, the cowboy may brag about things that he's done with his women. But the ones that brag loudest are the ones that are most likely queer.
Welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Willie Nelson with his new song. I don't have the title of it at my fingertips, but it is a marvelous bit of music there about gay cowboys. Apropos to conversations of the last couple of days, Senator Mike DeWine, the Republican senator from Ohio, is on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And you'll notice, if you go to Think Progress and just thinkprogress.org and just scroll down a ways, there's a picture of what looks like the Penguin from the Batman cartoons walking down the hall. I kid you not, it looks like the Penguin walking down the hall. It's actually Dick Cheney. And the AP reports that Cheney, you know, while we've all been talking about him shooting somebody, right? Behind the scenes, something's going on, and Mike DeWine's in charge of it. The AP reports Cheney has been playing the role of point man in the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program in the war on terror. Right? In other words, it's not Bush so much who's the lead guy in spying on all of us. It's Cheney, according to the Associated Press. And conservative critics of the program are now starting to shut up, according to the Washington Post. Why? Senate Intelligence Committee members attributed the shift to last week's closed briefings given by top administration officials to the full House and Senate Intelligence Committees and to private appeals to wavering GOP senators by officials, including Vice President Cheney. It's been a full-court press, said a top Senate Republican aide. In other words, Cheney's trying to put a lid on this thing, which could lead, conceivably, to the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. And they go on to say, the Washington Post goes on to say, Senate Intelligence Committee member Mike DeWine, Republican from Ohio, said in an interview that he supports Cheney's NSA spying program and would oppose a congressional investigation. He said he is drafting legislation that would specifically authorize this program by excluding it from the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. In other words, Mike DeWine is drafting legislation that he's going to introduce in the United States Senate. The United States Senate, by the way, that today passed the Patriot Act, Russ Feingold was trying to filibuster this thing. The only two senators who stood up and supported the filibuster, Jim Jeffords of Vermont and Robert Byrd of West Virginia. God bless them both. But the Senate overwhelmingly rejected an effort Thursday to block renewal of the renewing the Patriot Act. Actually, I can't say that they have passed the thing. They just shot down the effort to filibuster it. But in any case, you got Mike DeWine here. DeWine saying that everything Cheney and Bush have done is going to retroactively be legal and you can't prosecute them. The DeWine legislation would grant authority to the administration to continue to conduct its program without any legal checks or safeguards whatsoever on its power. Now, it's Mike DeWine, by the way, that Sherrod Brown is running against. 200 protesters marked the war in Iraq with a march and a rally on March 19, 2005. Across the street, a man and a woman who appeared to be in uniform marked at 2. This is from the Beacon Journal in Akron. One with a 35-millimeter camera, the other with a video camera. This time, the group gathered at the Akron Summit County Public Library in downtown Akron to hear testimony about the U.S. military's civilian spying. Mickey Sefenik, an Akron resident, says, if anybody from the FBI or Department of Defense is here, this is my good side. He then encouraged spies to take a picture of the message on his T-shirt, protect the Bill of Rights. The standing room only crowd joined representatives from the ACLU and U.S. Representative Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown's office to hear about a dozen residents and group members demand government accountability for its secret eavesdropping program. And in the meantime, I guess finally the other shoe is dropping. The Nation magazine reported late yesterday afternoon that the reason why Paul Hackett dropped out of the race was because he himself had commissioned a poll in his district. And, well, I'll quote The Nation. It appears an even bigger factor was a poll that shows Hackett trailing far behind his progressive primary opponent, U.S. Representative Sherrod Brown, with the filing deadline for the May Democratic primary rapidly approaching. Neither of these guys were actually in the primary. Hackett was confronted with new numbers from his own pollster, which showed Brown was ahead by among likely voters by an almost 2-to-1 margin of 46% for Congressman Brown to 24% for Hackett. And so he pulled out. The poll details were obtained by the Cleveland Plain Dealer, revealed that Hackett had made few inroads among Democrats outside his southern Ohio base. And so let's hope that he will run for against Mean Gene's seat in his southern Ohio base, where he's doing well. But this is, apparently, this was really what it was all about, is that Hackett did the polling, he paid for the poll, he looked at the poll, and the poll said, you're going to lose. And so he pulled out. Ah, yes, life goes on. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore.
Welcome back, my friends.
See those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the squares, a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to Reaganville and Bushville. That's the world that they have brought us with their insane international trade policies, the so-called world is flat madness, and their absolutely nutty tax policies. Let's borrow and spend. And let's borrow and give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, but borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars in the name of every family in the United States. You think you own your home? If you're a family of four, you owe over $120,000 to the federal government right now for the money that they've borrowed. You're paying $4,000 this year in interest payments on the money that they've borrowed from who? From China, from Saudi Arabia. Now you have the United Arab Emirates owning the ports of New York and New Jersey. The country that was the finance through whose banking system the financing went to the hijackers, you know, where a lot of the hijacking planning was done. You say, whoa, what is going on here with this? It is just getting very, very strange. It is just getting, I got to say it again, it is just getting very, very strange. The country being sold out from underneath us. Now the federal government wants to sell off millions of acres of land. This is, again, part of the Republican program to simply privatize everything. Let's not have any government anymore. Let's just have the corporations run everything. And if you don't like it, you can call that toll-free number and try and take it up with that person in India who answers the phone. You'd think I'm kidding. I am not. I mean, that's where they're at. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Robert, in Camano Island, Washington?
Camano Island.
Camano. Okay, great. Camino. Hey, Robert, what's up?
I just wanted to report a conversation I had with a guy who voted for Bush twice, and he thinks he's the only person on Earth who's figured out what's really going on, and that Bush's supposed undermining of our civil liberties and lying and wiretapping is actually just a feint, like a military feint, like the way we faked out the Japanese in the Battle of Midway, made them think we were going to the Aleutians and got them to move the wrong way and attack them. And what we're doing, and the Democrats are all in on this, they're performing, it's all acting, is that this is all a ploy to make the terrorists believe that Bush is capable of anything, and that they have no way of predicting what he will do. And that
in other words, he's destroying his own nation to prove to them that he's capable of being irrational?
Of being irrational, of doing anything that they can't, you know, there's no way to calculate what he might do. And I think he's already got detention centers all over the world. He's torturing people. He's raping kids in front of their parents. I mean,
well, he's not, but there have been documented cases of that happening, yes.
Yeah, the second batch of videotapes that they don't want to release from
right.
Abu Ghraib and all this stuff. I mean, I think they pretty much already know we're capable of anything without putting on an elaborate show that he's dismantling the government and the Democrats are...
Yeah, and what happened to the traditional idea? This is what I would ask your Republican friends. What happened to the traditional Republican, Democratic, slash American view of America as a beacon of liberty in the world, as the example to the planet of liberty in the world? What happened to that?
I don't know, but he thinks of it as like a military strategy, and it's almost like Nixon and Kissinger's idea of brinksmanship.
Yeah,
you know, that would make them say that.
Well, like mutually assured destruction, the MAD theory that in theory prevented a nuclear war. I think that you can poke some fairly substantial holes in that, but I don't want to refight the Cold War this afternoon. But yeah, I get it.
He keeps going back to military, you know, fainting on the battlefield. And then when I tried to say something back, he says, well, you can't attack them with tanks. He says, this isn't like on a military battlefield. And I said, but that's where you're drawing your analogy from.
It's irrational. Robert, I thank you for the call and for the depressing perspective of your conservative friend. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Wow, that was interesting.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring across 2 points. This was reported this morning with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Mm-hmm. One was, and I don't know if you wanted to touch on it briefly today, the nonviolent protest by the Iraqis, and then they were beaten by the British soldiers.
You're talking about in 2004, the one that the video that has just surfaced that Tony Blair's all upset about?
Yes, exactly.
That story has been in the mainstream media for 3 or 4 days now.
Yeah, it's been in the 3 or 4 days, but what they did is on Democracy Now! They touched on it a little closer. They kind of tied it into the Abu Ghraib Iraqis that were basically, there were some that, you know, were obviously tortured and beaten, but several were also killed. They have a picture of a guy. If people go on salon.com, they can see these photos. They have a guy with his throat slit.
Oh, I've got the photos here. Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
they're also over at the Sydney Morning Herald. And here's the thing, Patricia. For example, the British, when they were fighting against us, they figured that, you know, we would field an army and they'd field an army and their army was going to be bigger and they'd win. And if that had been the way it worked, they would have won. But we fought an insurgency against them. Now, the only way that an insurgency can be successful is if the non-combatant populace, that is, if the average, you know, mom and dad, if the average family is willing to take the combatants into their home and hide them, that's or at least not to turn them in, not to dial 911 and say, hey, we got a nut with a gun here in the backyard hiding out. That's the only way that an insurgency can work. And by taking tens of thousands of Iraqis in these huge sweeps, taking them into places like Abu Ghraib and humiliating them for a couple of days, finding out that they have no intelligence value, and then tossing them back out into the general population. What we have done, in addition to the fact that we haven't brought back the utilities, and they're looking at us going, this is the greatest power in the world, how come they can't turn our lights on? How come our hospitals aren't working the way they used to? But the main thing, I think, is this massive humiliation. And we wonder, why is it that over 80% in the last survey of Iraqis think it's okay to attack Americans? It doesn't mean that they're doing it, but they're allowing it to happen. We cannot stop an insurgency as long as the average person in Iraq views us as the occupiers and as bad folks. And that's what Bush has brought us, with the absolute, utter, mind-boggling, criminal negligence and incompetence by which he has managed and maintained this occupation.
Exactly. He's turning, the funny thing is that Iraqis have never, if we studied the past of the Iraqis, they've never been, I've never understood they've been involved in terrorism or...
There has never been, before we arrived, there had never been a terrorist incident in Iraq, and the Iraqis have always historically been pro-American until 1991.
Absolutely. So now we're turning them into extremists too, so...
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well, if you're one of Tim LaHaye's guys, if you're one of those ones who believes that the rapture's coming and you got to create a war in the Middle East, and I believe George Bush is, I believe that that's a much bigger factor than anybody wants to talk about, frankly, then it starts to make sense that they might actually think that this is a decent game plan. But beyond that, it just seems like general insanity. Patricia, thanks a lot. Yeah.
One more thing, I'm sorry, if I may, because I know you want to get to other callers. If you could touch on today also, the UN is calling for the closing of Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, that was, a couple of days ago, actually.
Okay, I'm sorry, apologize.
No, it's okay. We've mentioned it on the program, but we didn't really do a whole full-court press on it. Yeah, the UN, and they said that the reason why is twofold. Number one, it's extrajudicial. It's outside the boundary of U.S. law, and it's outside the boundary of U.N. law. And number two, that there's clear evidence that torture has happened there. They sent some folks down who were never allowed to actually interview the inmates, but they were able to see the place, and they said, these conditions in and of themselves constitute torture. Indefinite incarceration in solitary confinement constitutes torture, not to mention, the physical things that have been done.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome, Patricia. Thanks a lot for the call. Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Ken.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I've been waiting for your show today because I figured you'd be jumping on this Cheney conversation with Britt Hume, where Britt Hume asked him about the spying, the leaking of the Valerie Plame situation, and where Cheney said that as vice president, he's given authority to declassify certain information.
Right.
And, it seems like if he is, I imagine the George Bush probably has the authority, but don't they have to go through some certain procedures, sign some documents, inform the people, the organizations and the people, the agents that are involved in that to protect them so the agencies can protect themselves?
I don't know. I don't know the details of that. But what I do know is that that's not the right question. Cheney is not accused of illegally declassifying documents. Cheney is accused of leaking classified documents that were never declassified, this day are still secret.
But he's insinuating that he declassified it.
I know. What he's doing is like my asking you, how's your dog? And you say, I have a new cat. And I act as if you just answered my question, right? When we both know that you still have a dog, too. In other words, Brett Hume asked a question, and Cheney gave him an answer that had nothing to do with the question. Cheney and the American media is acting like he actually answered the question. It's pretty mind-boggling when you consider it.
Well, yeah, I would think if he is saying that he declassified the information before he told Scooter Libby that he could talk about it, that there'd be had to some type of, documentation that he had to sign or something.
Oh, yeah, declassification. Declassification, yeah, absolutely. Declassification is a process that actually requires some action. But again, he has not been accused of illegally declassifying information. What he has been accused of by his own associate, Scooter Libby, who drove with him to work every morning, what he has been accused of is leaking classified information. And Britt Hume did not say, do you have the authority, or what Britt Hume should have said, what any other reporter, anybody who wasn't, a suck-up,
would have followed up on that.
Yeah,
sure.
Would have said, hey, wait a minute, you're accused of leaking classified information. We're not talking about whether or not you have the authority to declassify information. You're accused of leaking classified information. And that's what we need to keep on, and I agree with you, Cannon, and we do need to keep on it. And it's in my stack. It's in my stack. But you brought it to the top. Thank you very much. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Cowboys frequently secretly fond of each other. Say, what do you think all them saddles and boots was about?
There's a bar down the street looks like that.
There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels for his brother. And inside every cowboy there's a lady that'd love to slip out.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. You want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. Frank in Roseville, California on the line. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, a couple of things, actually. First, I wanted to disagree with you on your Hackett comments earlier.
Okay, you're actually disagreeing not with me, but with The Nation magazine.
Okay. All right.
Let me just read you and then you can respond to it. This is from The Nation, which is not certainly not an organ of the Democratic Party. I mean, the Nation, in fact, regularly takes the Democratic Party and bitch slaps them. Right? But anyhow, here The Nation. Paul Hackett, who has dropped out of the race for the Democratic U.S. Senate nomination with his usual theatrical flourishes, now says he quit the contest because of the pressure he claims he felt from national Democratic bigwigs. That may well have been a factor in Hackett's decision, but it appears that an even bigger factor was a poll that showed Hackett trailing far behind his progressive primary opponent, U.S. Representative Sherrod Brown. With the filing deadline for the May Democratic primary rapidly approaching, Hackett was confronted with new numbers from his own pollster, which showed Brown was ahead among likely voters by an almost 2-to-1 margin, 46% for the congressman to 24% for Hackett. Despite the fact that Hackett had been campaigning for the Senate seat since last fall, while Brown had been tied up in Washington leading the fight against CAFTA and other administrative and blocking other administration initiatives, the poll, details which were obtained by the Cleveland Plain Dealer, revealed that Hackett had made few inroads among Democrats outside of his Southern Ohio base. This is not to say that Hackett was a bad candidate. An Iraq War veteran gained national attention with his blunt criticism of President Bush during the campaign for an Ohio U.S. House seat that he almost won in a special election last summer. Hackett would have made a serious contender in a Senate race against just about anybody else. But Hackett had a hard time convincing most Ohio Democrats, particularly more liberal voters in the northern Ohio counties where the party is strongest, that he would be a bolder or better candidate than Brown, who was an early and consistently outspoken critic of the Bush administration's rush to war in Iraq and who is one of the House's leading foes of corporate excess. End of article.
Right. And I happened to look at that poll. It was published in the Plain Dealer. I looked at the online version of the Plain Dealer the other day. And the poll gave some good news to Hackett as well. It said that Brown's support was not strong support, and that when voters were given more information about Hackett, that they actually supported Hackett. Now, I don't think Brown is a bad candidate either, but I think that, okay, you say it's not you, it's The Nation saying this. Well, I think they're speculating and reporting it, making it seem like it's fact, and it's really speculation.
Well, here are the facts. Hackett had a poll done. The poll showed that he was 2-to-1 behind his opponent. Hackett dropped out of the race.
Yeah, that is true, but it ignores certain parts of the poll which said that the support for Brown was not strong. It was weak support.
Well, then Hackett should have stayed in the race.
Well, I don't disagree with you there, but that doesn't mean that's the reason. I think Hackett probably was saying the true thing, that he was forced out of the race.
But Hackett didn't say that.
Go ahead.
Hackett didn't say that. I have not been able to find one single published story where Paul Hackett is quoted as saying that. I know that a talk show host said that, but I have not been able to find any place where Paul Hackett actually said that.
If it's the talk show host I'm thinking of, he had Hackett on his show.
And I heard Paul Hackett on that program in the third hour of it, and Paul Hackett did not say that he was asked to leave that race or that he was pushed out.
I think he implied it. I have one other point, though, that I wanted to make on a different issue.
Sure.
Condoleezza Rice wants to push harder for labor unions in Iran. And I think that's awfully...
That's ironic.
Yeah, yeah. There's
Since we made them illegal. Well, actually, yes. Saddam made them illegal, but we maintained that.
Yeah. There's an article by Warren P. Strobel, Knight Ridder Newspapers, about that in today's B.
Amazing. Well, I'll have to take a look for that. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for a thought-provoking conversation. I appreciate it. Will in Brea, California. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Truth Teller. How's he doing, man?
I'm well.
Wait, cool. I just wanted to jump onto the idea that George Bush is making up for lost time from his own family history. He's still pissed off because his grandfather's had some stuff taken away when he was trying to Nazify us back in World War II.
Back in the 40s, yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is kind of a payback in the little...
Well, that was when the Bush family declared a jihad against the Democrats, and Prescott Bush decided that his son was going to, you know, he was going to create a political dynasty, and you know, he was going to take on Roosevelt's legacy, and they have, and they still are.
Oh, so is that why they were so afraid of the word Nazi for so long? I mean, now everybody's kind of leaning away from the idea that you can't say certain words, but then again, maybe not with the Patriot Act. What is all be put in that now?
Yeah.
Am I going to end up in jail for having a big FUW on my front, on my chest for freedom underwear?
I just don't know. But what I can tell you is that what I know for sure, Will, is that these guys are just hell-bent for leather to undo and thank you for the call, to undo the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, whether it's minimum wage protections, whether it's unemployment protection, whether it's maximum hour laws, whether it's workplace protections, the ability and the right to unionize, Social Security. Their mantra is very straightforward.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
They're unambiguous. They're proud of it. They're just going straight ahead. That's, you know, all, that's what it's all about, and that's what they're going to go for. And here we have Bush coming out a couple of days ago, saying that he was pushing his private savings account for health insurance. So you look at the analysis of this; it's going to kick another 600,000 Americans off the health insurance rolls. 600,000 more Americans are going to be without any access to health care or health insurance other than emergency health care as a consequence of these programs. Not to mention the fact that Bush's biggest donors now, the financial services business, the banks and brokerage houses, are going to make out like absolute flaming bandits. Well, you know, that's business. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes you know what you think you know, and sometimes you don't even know what you think you know, and sometimes you don't even know what you need to know in order to know what you don't know so that you can know that you don't know, but you know that you need to know it, if you know what I mean.
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Is it possible that the Homeland Security Department, that the government of the United States is preparing for martial law right here on U.S. soil? Peter Dale Scott is with us. Peter Dale Scott wrote a great piece for the Pacific News Service just a week or so ago. He's a professor at the University of California and a marvelous researcher on a wide variety of topics over the years. Peter Dale Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
It's always an honor to have you with us, sir. You start out your article by pointing out that Halliburton or a Halliburton subsidiary just received a $385 million contract from the Department of Homeland Security to construct here in the United States. Now, we know that they've already built the concentration camps down in Guantanamo Bay, but these are within the continental United States what are called temporary detention and processing capabilities. What's this all about?
Well, the Homeland Security has a new program, long-term program called Endgame, and the idea is to have the facilities to be able to round up, detain, and remove. They used to say deport, but deport was a legal procedure. Now they're talking about detention and removal of large categories of undesirable people. And what's particularly alarming, both about the contract and also about Endgame, that they're very open-ended, because they say that detention removal includes detained population, includes economic migrants, but also down at the end, potential terrorists.
And so if these, so this, you know, I mean, you've got a bunch of folks out there who are hysterical about illegal immigration, and I'm concerned about it, frankly, for its economic impact. It seems to me like
it. Yeah, I think that the core of the program really is to deal with illegal immigrants.
But the way, this thing has been written, if the government decides that you or I are potential terrorists because they don't like something we say, we can get herded into that same boxcar.
Yes, and of course, remember Ashcroft back in 2002, I think it was, he was attacked because he had announced that there would be camps for U.S. citizens who he determined to be enemy combatants, and they actually did pick up two of these citizens.
Right, Jose Padilla being most famous.
There was a big flap about that, and Ashcroft is gone, but that's the way the government is thinking. And this contract also is open-ended because it's primarily to deal with immigrants. I believe that. But it says for other new programs, you know, so to support the rapid development of new programs. So it's there's a little trap door at the back of the immigrant problem that can use it for anything.
This is the camel's nose under the tent. Now, this is nothing new. Ollie North had something like this with the Rex 84 program.
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
The planning for this really began under the Reagan. Well, you know, you can go back as far as you like, but the active planning to get rid of dissidents was a feature of emergency planning in the Reagan years, with which Oliver North was connected. And it got into the Iran-Contra hearings because Congressman Brooks asked Oliver North if it was true that he was involved with plans to suspend the American Constitution. Well, the answer to that actually was yes, but he never got an answer to the question because Senator Inouye, who is in charge of the hearing, pounded his gavel and said, if we're going to talk about this, we have to do it in executive session. And what we now know, we didn't know then, is particularly surprising and alarming about this secret planning to suspend the Constitution, which they call continuity of government planning. I always say they should really call it change of government planning. COG are the initials for it. The planning was being done very, very secretly in the 1980s under a team of people who included people not in the government. And two of the names that we would recognize today as being significant in this secret planning were Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, even though Donald Rumsfeld at the time was the head of a drug company.
Yeah. Now, really, this goes, I mean, we can track this way back. There was a shadow government that was set up that was going to run the United States during the Roosevelt administration. General Smedley Butler blew that thing sky high. One of the big banking companies had come to him and asked if he would be involved in a coup d'etat against Franklin Roosevelt.
That's true.
And then we get into the Cold War era, and there were plans to build an underground bunker. And in fact, it's constructed outside of Washington, D.C., and then there's another one out in the Midwest. Where the senior government officials could go in the event of a nuclear war.
Absolutely right. But, you know, I will say in defense of the Eisenhower people, first of all, people were very, very freaked about the possibility of nuclear war.
I remember it well. I'm that duck and cover generation.
And that the planning then was exclusively restricted to planning for a nuclear attack. But
right, and then in the 70s it changed. In the 70s it became when African Americans started rioting in the cities, then they started planning for a black uprising.
Yes, we got a host of cable splicer, those plans were exposed, and a lot of people, there were hearings held by Senator Ervin, and a lot of people thought that the military was going to get out of that sort of thing. But almost every administration has played a role in this. President Carter's administration, actually FEMA was set up under President Carter with the a lot of input from a man called Samuel Huntington, who makes no secret about the fact that he thinks there's too much democracy in the United States. He wrote a book to this effect.
Yeah.
And FEMA, from its public face, has always been to deal with national emergencies like Katrina. But from the very beginning, it had a component for dealing with, terrorist crises.
Or insurrections?
What?
Or insurrections? Sorry, we only have a couple of minutes left here. We're speaking with Peter Dale Scott, peterdalescott.net, his website. Peter Dale Scott, I hear constantly that FEMA has hundreds or dozens of concentration camps already built all over the United States, ostensibly to house people in the event of an emergency. I'm wondering, A, if that's true, and B, if that's true, why didn't they put the people from Katrina there?
Well, I've just been looking at that on the web, and there are stories about people who, people say that people from Katrina were put in camps. They commandeered religious summer camps and things like that, declared
right.
them to be FEMA camps.
Yeah, I saw that.
And people went to these camps and tried to deliver food and were told, no, you can't. The FEMA officials intervened. There's debate about this because FEMA issued a response to this and said there'd been some misunderstanding on the local level.
Yeah.
But it's clear that the intention, as in Endgame, this is a document. If you search for Endgame on Google and Homeland Security, you can actually see the program. They want to have these massive facilities. I have to say also that the $385 million contract was actually a vast expansion of a previously existing contract. KBR has been doing this. It started under Clinton, but it was a fairly modest contract allotted in 2000.
Now, you said it started back in the 80s with Rumsfeld and Cheney. Rumsfeld and Cheney still in power. Are Rumsfeld and Cheney the driving force behind this now?
I think particularly Cheney, yes.
Cheney,
we have to relate this to the warrantless eavesdropping because that was part of the secret planning too. And Cheney said very frankly after it was exposed in December, he said to a group of journalists on an airplane that Watergate and Iran-Contra had been very bad for the nation because they had eroded the legitimate powers of the president to do what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And he has been actively planning, both back in the 80s and now when he's vice president. Really, his office has become really more important, really, than the national security staff of the president.
Well, he's become more important than the president. He can shoot a guy in the face and wait 2 days to call up his boss, the president, and tell him about it.
This is a great. There has never been a vice president like this before in the history of the United States.
Yeah, it's Darth Vader revisited. Absolutely remarkable. PeterDaleScott.net, the website, the program Endgame, $385 million from the Department of Homeland Security going to KBR, the Enron subsidiary that was actually reincorporated offshore so they didn't have to pay U.S. taxes on the money they make. Peter Dale Scott, thank you so much for being with us today and laying this out for us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's a fascinating story. Thank you. PeterDaleScott.net for more information. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This here's a land of plenty, and plenty's what it takes to get some health insurance in these old United States. I just know I shouldn't have to go bankrupt or on the street if the cancer comes a-calling, as it might for you or me. I
God
ran into a congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C. So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day."
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And George W. Bush has got a new program out there. He's flogging this thing. Let's have health savings accounts. Yes, save some money out of your paycheck, and when you get sick, you can pay for it. Isn't that great? Except the average cancer diagnosis in America represents $250,000 for the medical industry. Amazing. John Kenney, who just finished his first novel, writes a piece in the L.A. Times today. Vice President Dick Cheney accidentally shot documentary filmmaker Michael Moore yesterday as Moore was walking out of a Manhattan's Denny's. A spokesperson for the vice president said it was a complete accident and that Cheney felt horrible. The White House released a statement saying the shooting was just bad timing. Vice President Cheney, who is well-versed in firearm safety, was merely sitting in a shrub wearing camouflage outside of a Denny's frequented by Mr. Moore. The statement went on to say that Cheney had been in the shrub for several days. Moore is said to have suffered only minor injuries and was released from the hospital. In another bizarre incident, Cheney mistakenly shot every Democratic member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. White House spokesman said that the vice president feels bad, but not that bad. An aide to Cheney said that the vice president happened to be in the committee chambers under a chair when he stood up to put on a pair of chaps, accidentally shooting the committee members, stopping to reload three times. Remarkably, the committee members were largely unhurt and expected to make complete recoveries. White House was put on the defensive again today when Air Force Two was forced to make an emergency landing 25 miles west of New York City after a loss of cabin pressure because of the accidental shooting of former FEMA Director Michael D. Brown and Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff. Both men have recently come under criticism. Cheney was said to be laughing but also deeply concerned when he was awoken from a nap after accidentally shooting the men at close range. I guess it's reached the point where it's just not funny anymore. John Kenney there with a little bit of humor from the L.A. Times, I suppose. But really, I think it's time for us to get back to looking at, I mean, the real issue here and the thing that the Republicans are really concerned about is the fact that Scooter Libby is saying it was Cheney who committed treason. You'll recall, you know, that treason was committed. You remember? I mean, yeah, this is something. George W. Bush.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration. And there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it takes Dick Cheney 2-3 days to call George Bush and tell him he shot a guy in the face. It might take him a couple months to tell him that he's been leaking classified information. Of course George doesn't have any idea. Now, we shouldn't be surprised, should we? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And let's see here. Tom in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
I'm listening to this Cheney shooting his friend issue, and I've heard very little about the fact that when a person goes into an emergency room, whether it's a knife wound, self-inflicted, or a gunshot wound, the emergency room is mandated to contact the police.
That's right.
And if Mr. Cheney had followed his so-called friend in need to the hospital, he would have not only been subjected to that, but the possibility of a UA or a blood sample taken for any drugs or alcohol related to that issue.
Yeah, and this is a discussion that, in fact, I thought it was interesting. Last night on Joe Scarborough's program, Al Franken was on there, and he was saying, hey, you know, if and he made a really good point. I thought it was an excellent point. He said, if I shot somebody, just out of respect, particularly a friend, I'd go to the hospital just to sit there with them and make sure they're okay. You know, if you shot somebody, so would you. And, you know, people say, well, it's the vice president. You don't want a whole entourage around. Well, yeah, you can sit on a different floor, you know. I mean, you don't have to, you know, we're not saying you need to sit in the same room with them or something, but you'd want to know. Why would you not show up at the hospital? Well, because somebody might say, hey, you're the guy who did the shooting. Hook yourself up to this breathalyzer machine. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is on the line. Hey, Victoria, what's the take in Washington, D.C. on this?
Well, it's very interesting. I just got out of the White House press briefing, and I was also speaking to some reporters afterwards who've been speaking with other administration people. And the really unspoken story here is the huge rift between the vice president's office and the president's office, not only on this, but that this has really underlined what is a huge rift between the two offices, how they don't get on, and how the vice president operates independently, and how in this case the president's office was basically cut out of the loop.
Does this mean that the president and the vice president are on the outs, or just that their people aren't talking?
That's not clear. Their people aren't talking. As far as we know, those two are talking. But he is so autonomous, the vice president, that if he makes a decision to do something, the very senior administration officials for President Bush are not really in a position to say, look, this is what the president wants. If he says, look, I'll handle this, then they kind of have to let him handle it.
Hmm. Amazing. This is unprecedented, I take it.
That's what people are saying. Yeah, this is unprecedented. And people are concerned about it.
Now, we have a vice president out of control. It may well be.
That could be a conclusion, yes.
Yeah. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for the report today.
Thank you.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I am a patriot, and I love my country, because my country is all I know. I want to be with my family.
And welcome back, my friend. My friends, our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Or smalldog.com. You can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things computer. Give them a call and tell them I said hi. 1-800-511-MAX here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. And now, it's our JAWS alert. Hole in the ozone layer expected to increase. The hole in the ozone layer could grow significantly over the next few years, reigniting fears over skin cancer, cataracts, and damage to vulnerable plant life. According to scientists in Germany, changes in the sun's atmosphere have delayed natural repairs to the layer of gas high in the stratosphere and are about to trigger further ozone losses. They say the ozone layer, which shields the Earth from the worst of ultraviolet radiation, may not begin to recover until the end of the decade. Martin Damaris, who led the research at the Institute for Atmospheric Physics in Wesseling, said, and I quote, "The ozone hole will stay around for another 4 or 5 years. We can't expect it to start to recover until 2010, and then it will take another 40 to 50 years to repair completely. And the only reason it's putting itself back together is because we've reduced the level of the production of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs. You recall when Ronald Reagan was asked about this, you know, what are you going to do about this ozone hole? You know, it's... Yeah, all this ultraviolet radiation coming down, causing cancers and things. And Reagan's advice was, well, people have to start wearing hats and carrying umbrellas. Yeah, except that all the other animals can't do that when the levels get so high that they start getting blinded and they start getting cancer. All the plants can't do that when they start getting burned. I mean, you know, the downside consequences of this thing are absolutely mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling. Ron in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Ron?
Say, I'm trying to figure out this Constitution on the president and vice president on this Cheney and Libby deal. To me, when I read the Constitution, it says the executive power is only in the president.
That's right. The vice president is technically a member, I believe. I'm not an attorney, but my understanding of this is that the vice president is a member of the legislative branch. His two official jobs are to be the lady in waiting in the event that the president is incapacitated or dies or whatever. And number one, and number two, and actually I should reverse the order of these, because his main job, what he is supposed to do on a regular basis, is to be the president of the Senate. Although the Senate, to make it easy on the vice president, has a rotating presidency. So when Cheney in the campaign said to John. Who's the guy who's running for vice president? Anyhow, said to him, John Edwards, thank you, that I'm the president of the Senate. It's my job to administer the Senate. I've never seen you, Mr. Edwards. Phony baloney. I mean, once a year he actually goes in there and slams a gavel. They actually have senators who take turns playing the role of senator.
My line of thought: if Cheney gave an executive order that Libby could start outing Valerie Plame, wouldn't it be up to him to report to the president right away, so the president's not out of the loop on this stuff?
You would think so.
wouldn't the president then know right away what's going on? And this went on for a long time.
Yeah, you would think so. I encourage you to actually read Article 2 of the Constitution. It runs about a page and a half long.
I got it in front of me now. I've been reading it. And I just don't interpret it the way Mr. Cheney does.
Yeah, the only place, as far as I can tell, in Article 2 where the vice president is mentioned, he's mentioned twice in here, once where in a case of removal of the office, as death, resignation, or inability, you know, blah, 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 then the vice president comes in and takes over. Number one, that's from Article 6, or Paragraph 6 of Article 2, Section 2. And then in Section 4, it says the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
I just think that President Bush had to know about this right away, because I don't think Cheney can do this stuff without reporting to him.
Yeah. No, I don't think he can either. And so either what Victoria Jones said is right, there is a huge schism going on in the White House, and we have a dysfunctional administration, which may account for things like why Katrina happened, or at least some part of it. There's a coup d'etat has happened, and Cheney has taken power of this government, has taken control of this government. Cheney and his cronies, like his good buddy Rumsfeld, who's been with him for, 30-some-odd years now in various activities, and that George W. Bush no longer has any power.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty spooky thing to think. Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call, Ron. I mean, that's a pretty spooky thing to think, because Cheney is the guy who's, Bush is the guy who technically was elected president of the United States. I don't think he was, but nonetheless, there he is. He's sitting in that office. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I saw on the computer, on AOL News, that FEMA has 10,000 trailers sitting, I believe it's Lackland Air Force Base.
No, they're not. Lackland is outside San Antonio. They're in Hope, Arkansas. Oddly enough, the town where Bill Clinton was born.
Now they're going to destroy them because they said that they're sinking in the mud there.
That's right.
In the meantime, before they destroy them, they're going to order 40,000. There's 10,000 trailers. 40,000 jacks to jack them up. And then they're going to destroy them. And what they're doing there, they're paying rent to the Air Force Base.
Not to mention the $300 million that they paid to some contractor crony buddy of the Bush administration to buy these things in the first place.
Right. Well, they were never inspected, you know, by a government inspector. So we don't even know if there's any insides to them or anything. But the thing I'm concerned about is taking all this money from FEMA and then the rent part, paying it to the Air Force Base. Wouldn't that in reality be taking FEMA money and giving it to the Defense Department? You know, that's strange.
Yeah.
That's a hidden tax that the people are paying more into the Defense Department.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to bring up about is the bank they have in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
where they had on the news where you could go in and get money, the Iraqis can, and there's no bookkeeping on it. And I was just wondering, we had a rash of congressmen go over there and visit this spring. Do you think there's any possibility they could have been gone over there and siphoning money out of that bank?
A lot of them came back and said, "Oh, everything is wonderful," and maybe they brought a brick back with them. A $100 bills. But I think it's unlikely, frankly, Jim.
Well, there's $2 billion. It's unexplained.
There's actually $8 billion. That's unexplained.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think we should quit worrying about someone who was drinking and hunting and get back on these issues, because I think they wanted this as a smokescreen, you know, at the incident with the hunting.
I agree. I'm over it with electoral politics, and I'm over it with, or at least Ohio politics, and I'm over it with Cheney drunk or not? In my opinion, you know, as Tucker Carlson said on his program last night, you just don't drink and then shoot. Even one beer, you just don't do it. It's wrong.
And I would never even go out with someone. But the thing is, was he getting the alcohol out of his system? Is that why they waited till Sunday? It's a good point.
That's my take. That's been my take on it from the very beginning. I mean, I've known enough alcoholics in my life to working in news. I mean, I would say virtually every hit and run that I've ever reported on, and I did news for 7 years back in Lansing, Michigan, and you know, we've got a real active newsroom here in Oregon, where I'm in Portland, where I'm broadcasting from now. Virtually every hit and run The reason it's a hit and run rather than just an accident is because the hitter was drunk and wanted to get home to sober up before they got caught. And their judgment is so impaired they don't realize or they're unaware of the law that being a hit and run is a worse crime than being, you know, drunk on the scene. So, anyhow, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Parviz in Larchmont, New York. Hey, Parviz.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's up?
Well, I'm talking about Iran's situation. You know, there are other options that the Bush is not following because what they want to do, they want to do what they did with Iraq, have an enemy so they can win the election. This is Karl Rove's, you know, strategy. I have a simple solution. I'm American-Iranian, 42 years here, and what I want to say is this. Offer Iranians this choice. You can enrich it to the fuel level, but we'll have a lot of inspectors over there, and you have to be transparent, and we'll have good relations, and they can help us with Iraq and everything else because they have power over there, and that would be the end of it. And now they're bringing Israel, bro. They're bringing other issues, muddy the, you know, the water, so they can get elected. Now they want to have the Jewish population here, and some of them are so gullible to vote.
Well, don't you think, Parviz?
Yes.
I mean, as an Iranian or American of Iranian ancestry.
Yes.
Don't you think that the demagogues, and I'll be the first to acknowledge that George W. Bush and Condi Rice are playing the demagogue card. I mean, they're playing that. But don't you think that that's happening on the Iranian side, too?
Sure. Of course.
Yeah.
But then two demagogues should get together.
But we need to ignore it.
Problem.
Yeah, we need to ignore it because it's just Mr. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is not doing himself any favors with his demagoguery, although maybe it plays well to the local audience. I don't know.
Yeah, I wish he was wiser. Actually, his local audience is not that big.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably talking about 20% of the population. Iranians are very advanced and very intellectual, progressive. And they don't like this.
Before the revolution, Iran was like, you know, the Paris of the Middle East.
Yes, unfortunately, you know, America changed our democracy in 1953 in a coup d'etat and put Shah in, or else we would be like Switzerland now. They don't want us to have democracy. And they say, why Muslim countries won't have democracy? We would have been the most advanced Muslim democratic secular government. But they did something that Ayatollahs came in so they can have permanent enemies so they can control our oil.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And
anyway,
we've seen this in country.
And
yeah,
I love, you know, my American, you know, fellow citizens, but I don't like Bush and Cheney and this bunch of criminals.
Yeah. Parviz, thank you very much for your opinion. I can't disagree with your assessment of the situation, and I think it's a tragedy that it's being handled so badly by this administration that it could lead to war. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. It's getting very strange over there in the House and Senate. Bill Frist seems to be in full meltdown mode. We've got, for example, this budget bill. Looks like there was an error in it. And the Constitution says that, you know, if the House and Senate vote on something, the president signs it, it's the law. You can't go in and change it. It's quite explicit about that. And several legal constitutional experts, law experts, contend that the budget bill the president signed on February 8th is not constitutionally permissible and is not the law. And to Honorable Dennis Hastert, this letter signed by Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, James Clyburn, John Larson, Vice Chair of the Democratic Caucus, John Dingell, Ranking Member of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, Charles Rangel, Ranking Member of the Committee on Ways and Means, John Spratt, Ranking Member of the Committee on Budget, Henry Waxman, Ranking Member of the Committee on Government Reform, Steny Hoyer, the Democratic Whip. Because of the mistake by the Senate clerk, the House and Senate passed different versions of S-1932. This is the budget bill. On February 8th, the President signed into law the Senate version of the bill, despite the fact that the House never voted on the bill. On that version, before the bill was sent to the president for his signature, the bill was changed yet again from the version the House had narrowly approved. Even though there were valid means at your disposal to fix the problem, you apparently chose to ignore that option. The integrity of the House requires that you take two steps to address this serious situation. First, we insist that you inform the American people of what happened and that you recognize the abuse of this process. Yeah, right. Asking a Republican to confess that they screwed something up. Second, we urge you to reconsider this legislation this week and to work with the Senate to ensure that any spending reconciliation bill that is passed is identical in both the House and the Senate as the Constitution demands, and then presented to the President for his signature. Ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee David Obey and 20 other senators and representatives sent another letter to Speaker Hastert and Frist asking for immediate action. In this case, the defense appropriations bill. Many of us work closely with our colleagues in the majority to bipartisan, quack. In the meantime, Bill Frist has decided that rather than making sure that legislation is legal, that he's not going to allow debate on a $70 billion tax cut unless the bill extends deductions for capital gains and dividends. In other words, people like his father, one of the richest men in America, one of the Forbes 400, his father worth several billion dollars as a result of the enormous profits that you can make in the health industry right now in the United States, the way it's set up. You know, you and I get screwed. These guys, Bill Frist and his daddy, get so incredibly rich. I mean, Frist, a multimillionaire, his father, his brother, the head of the company, you know, billionaires. And so those folks who make their money or make a good chunk of their money as capital gains or dividends, you know, I like to say sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the check to arrive. Well, some of these people will actually work in offices and they take a salary of, you know, a few million dollars a year, but they're taking their billions of dollars a year in dividends. These guys want to have it stay the way it is right now. This is the result of Bush's last tax cut, maximum 15% tax on dividends and on capital gains, and no tax to be paid for Social Security. So you and I, we work for a living, we can pay up into the 30s in our income taxes and you know, nearly that, it seems, in our 6-8% in our Social Security tax. Our employer has to match that. But Bill Frist says he's going to go to the mat to protect millionaires and billionaires not having to pay normal taxes on dividends and capital gains. He's just going to, the $70 billion it's going to cost the United States. Can you imagine how many schools we could build with that money? Larry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Listening to you on AM 1090 in Seattle here.
Great.
Yeah. A quick aside, anybody interested in the Able Danger hearings, Lou Dobbs is supposed to interview Kurt Weldon, a representative today that's holding those hearings.
Yeah.
He was supposed to yesterday, but the hearings went into closed session, which was not a scheduled thing. So it looks like things may be getting hot in the Able Danger, as it refers to
the 9/11. For those who don't know, Able Danger is the project within the Pentagon that had discovered the 9/11 hijackers, discovered them on numerous occasions, knew a great deal about them, and somehow the Bush administration was so incompetent that they failed to do anything about this knowledge. Rumsfeld running the Pentagon failed to tell Bush about it, or maybe he did. I don't know. Maybe that's why when Bush got that presidential daily briefing on August 6th, 2001, that said bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States, he extended his vacation, took the longest vacation in the history of the United States presidency, and then when that was over and they still hadn't hit, instead of going back to Washington, D.C., he went to Florida, where his brother declared a state of emergency in the state. Who knows?
I have no idea, but I do know that on August the 29th of 2001, 2 weeks prior to the 9/11 happening, George Bush was in front of the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention, I believe it was in San Antonio that year, and he told everybody afterwards during a question and answer proceeding that we were going to war, and that the Social Security lockbox was only secure unless there was a national emergency or a war. So he told us, he was telegraphing at that time that we were going to war, and that was 2 weeks before 9/11.
Yeah.
But I wanted to give you a clarification, as well as I understood it, about the executive order that seems to be some controversy. I understand that George Bush was the one that issued the executive order authorizing Dick Cheney to disclose the classified information. And it was actually George Bush that did the issuing of the executive order.
How do you know that, Larry? I haven't seen that.
That was what was answered by Dick Cheney on the report after most of the questions by Brett Hume yesterday.
Interesting. I'll have to go back and look at that again, because I didn't get that. What I got was that Bush and Cheney felt that they had the ability to declassify, but the question was, did Cheney leak classified information? Whether he declassified it and then leaked it, I don't know. That's one for the lawyers, maybe? We'll see. Or maybe one for the impeachment proceedings. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, this is pretty amazing. I'm assuming it's true because I've got 5 different people out of the, I don't know how many people are in the chat room, 50 or so folks in the chat room. A half a dozen of them are saying that they just saw this thing on C-SPAN. Apparently, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney just read an article that I wrote in Common Dreams this week into the congressional record, and the Benedict at large says a little deserved gloating, perhaps. I read this article into the record of the House of Representatives. Basically, the gist of the article that I wrote, if you go to TomHartman.com and click on Articles on Democracy, it's the top one. Or for that matter, you can go to CommonDreams.org. It's scrolled down a ways because it came out on the 13th, but I think it's still on the homepage of CommonDreams.org. If not, you can go to TomHartman.com and find it. And the title of the article is Rumsfeld and Cheney Revived Their 70s Terror Playbook. And we talked about it on the program on the day that or the day after it was published, Monday or Tuesday of this week. I basically shared with you most of the information that's in the article. But, this is kind of cool. I guess that's pretty impressive. I'm easily impressed. You know, what can I say? But the larger issue, I think, is the reason why Congresswoman McKinney was reading that into the congressional record and was talking about it on the floor of the House of Representatives. And that is because in that article, I lay out what, frankly, I was informed about, and I reference this in the article, by a BBC documentary done by Adam Curtis called The Power of Nightmares. And in this BBC documentary, The Power of Nightmares by Adam Curtis, which is a 3-hour special that ran twice last year on the BBC, on BBC Channel 4, over a 3-night period. And there is discussion that it may come to the United States, that he's, editing this thing down. In this BBC special, what Adam Curtis does is he starts out by going back and looking at the genesis of both the modern Al-Qaeda movement and the modern neocon movement. And he finds that they both started in the American Midwest at about the same time in the late 1950s, early 1960s, with, in the case of the neocon movement, Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago, and in the case of the modern Al-Qaeda movement, with a fellow whose name is escaping me at the moment. I'll have to pull up my own article and get his name. He's an Egyptian name, who was as I recall, was in St. Louis. And who was, looking at the situation and saying, this is a terrible thing. What's going on? We can't have this. Yeah, it's actually not in that article, in that particular article. Maybe it is. Anyhow, I'm sorry, I don't have time to read my own article, and I don't recall the name. But the point is that these two movements both came out of this whole concern that, too much democracy was happening in the United States. We can't have too much democracy. We can't have people not being afraid. It's a dangerous thing. And so this really started out Okay, you want to see the whole thing about the whole detail thing. Actually, you'd have to go down to a previous article that I wrote on this called Hyping Terror for Fun and Profit, which you can also find at tomhartmann.com and click on Articles on Democracy. And that's the longer version of this, as it were, which I wrote about 2 years ago. In any case, here's how it started out. 1972, Richard Nixon came back from the Soviet Union, and him and Henry Kissinger had worked out this thing called détente. And Richard Nixon gave this speech. He said, Last Friday in Moscow, we witnessed the beginning of the end of that era, which began in 1945. And he's talking about the tension between the United States and the Soviet Union. With this step, we have enhanced the security of both nations. We have begun to reduce the level of fear by reducing the causes of fear for our two peoples and for all the people in the world. But Nixon left in a scandal. Gerry Ford came in, and guess who he brought with him? His Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, and his Chief of Staff, Dick Cheney. And these guys, what? We're going to have an end to fear? Thank you. Informed and Reborn in the chat room. Saeed Qutb was the Egyptian. And of course, with the neocons, there's a different genesis. And so with the neocons, you had Leo Strauss at the University of California, or at the University of Chicago, and he's looking around and he's going, this is a terrible thing, too much democracy. It's making this country dangerous. You got people having free sex, you got people taking drugs, you got people, there's riots in the streets and all, people rock and roll and Elvis, look at those hips, and this is going to lead to the destruction of society. We've got to get control of this. And the way to get control of it is to have the people under fear. And at the same time, Saeed Qutb was, as I recall, at the University of St. Louis, and he's looking around saying the same thing. And so he goes back to Egypt, and he doesn't found, but he becomes part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood, he was later put to death. He was executed by Sadat. And it was his guys who killed Sadat. And so when he was put to death by Sadat, his protege was a physician by the name of Ayman al-Zawahiri, who then went, when things started melting down in Egypt and Mubarak started going after these guys after Sadat was assassinated, he went to Afghanistan, and he took under his wing an impressionable young true believer Muslim by the name of Osama bin Laden. Zawahiri is often referred to as bin Laden's number two. It's actually the other way around. And meanwhile, at the University of Chicago, and these guys felt that in order to save the Muslim world from decadent Western civilization, they had to do away with democracy, and they had to have people living in fear, and they had to elevate religion. And in the meantime, you've got Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago saying, if we're going to save American civilization, we've got to raise religion. The irony, I suppose, this is a Jewish guy saying, let's elevate Christianity as the religion. Let's use this and promote it, and the neocons do. And his main disciple was a fellow by the name of Paul Wolfowitz. Is this starting to sound familiar? So anyhow, Rumsfeld comes along, and Rumsfeld comes in with Gerry Ford, comes in as the Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration, and he says, the Soviets have got this new submarine technology that is so advanced, it's non-acoustic, it's so advanced that we can't even find it. They could put a submarine off the coast of New York and nuke us tomorrow. We wouldn't even know about it. And therefore, we've got to spend billions, millions, trillions of dollars to combat this thing. The CIA looked at this thing and they said, there's no such thing. It's not there. Rumsfeld said, it is there. The CIA said, but we can find no evidence of it. And Rumsfeld said, well, see, that's proof. And the CIA is like, what? And Rumsfeld says, the fact that you can't find it is proof that it's undetectable. I kid you not. He really said this back in the 70s. In fact, Dr. Ann Kahn, she was the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency head from 77 to 1980, told the BBC, she said, and I'm quoting her, she said, They couldn't say that the Soviets had acoustic means of picking up American submarines because they couldn't find it. So they said, well, maybe they have a non-acoustic means of making our submarine fleet vulnerable. But there was no evidence that they had a non-acoustic system. They're saying, we just can't find evidence that they're doing it the way everybody thinks they're doing it, so they must be doing it a different way. We don't know what that different way is, but they must be doing it. Interviewer off camera, even though there was no evidence. Con, even though there was no evidence. Interviewer, so you're saying there, the fact that the weapon doesn't exist, con, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that we haven't found it. And then to sell this thing, they created this group called Team B. And Rumsfeld brings in Cheney for Team B. And Team B comes to the conclusion, all this stuff is linked, by the way, to Wikipedia. You can find all the gory details on this. I mean, this is not secret stuff. This is not, you don't need to wear a tinfoil hat to find this stuff or go into tinfoil hat territory. Find this stuff in the encyclopedia, in the Wikipedia. Team B. And Team B goes on this, fishing expedition and says, oh, yeah, it's got to be. If you can't find it, it must be there. The Soviet weapons of mass destruction, because there's no proof, that means that they're there. And Rumsfeld and Wolpowitz helped reorganize a group that had started back in the 1950s, the Committee for the Present Danger, to promote their worldview. They produced documentaries, publications. They provided guests for national talk shows, news reports. And pretty soon, everybody was terrorized again. And trillions of dollars, and years later, when the Soviet Union fell in the 1980s, we discovered that Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld had lied to America in the 70s about the Soviet weapons of mass destruction. What a surprise. And thank you to Cynthia McKinney for mentioning it on the floor of the House. This is a real issue. 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Caution for the warriors whose faith is not required. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. That's me, Tom Hartman. Glad to be here back with you. Now that Cynthia McKinney has apparently just read an article that I wrote into the Congressional Record and is speaking about it on the floor of the House of Representatives, we will get back to that, the details of that. And in fact, I want to get into the story behind the story on that in a few minutes, and we'll be taking your phone calls. But first, a little levity. A little levity sometimes can go a long way. Our guest today, cosmic comic and noted uncommentator Swami Beyond Ananda. Swami is the author of Swami for Precedent, a 7-step plan to heal the body politic and cure erectile dysfunction. And the Swami has just released his annual State of the Universe address. Welcome, Swami.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So the State of the Universe, what is the State of the Universe these days?
Well, the universe is doing just fine, thank you. Powering in perfection, ever-changing, same as always, and it's still expanding.
Expanding, eh?
Yes. You know the photon belt?
I've heard of it.
Well, they've actually had to let it out a notch.
That's a sure sign of expansion, sort of like my belt, but a little closer to home. What does the State of the Universe have to say about the State of the Union?
Well, you know, for years now we've been hearing shift happens, shift happens, shift happens, and now finally I think the shift is about to hit the fan.
Really?
Yes, I've been getting intelligence reports, and guess what? We Americans are actually becoming more intelligent. Of course, you wouldn't know it from the mainstream media. They're still feeding us babblum. Babblum, that is strained BS, designed to dumb us down and numb us up. But the good news is people are starting to wise up. And you know what that means? We're having an upwising.
Yeah, an upwising. People of the world are wise. Upwise. I like it. Tell me more.
Well, you know, people are waking up and wising up, and even the most unpleasant stories are starting to break through the soundless barrier and defy the president's don't ask, don't tell policy, which is, of course, you promise not to ask us what we're doing, and we promise not to tell you.
Like the recent NSA spying controversy?
Well, exactly right. You know how the progressives have been complaining? The president never listens to them? Well, turns out he's been listening all along. And as all of this comes out, more and more Americans realize they're not comfortable with the notion that the only way to defeat the evildoers is to out-evildo them.
So, Swami, how can we, the people, start this upwising?
Well, first of all, by daring to imagine something different. Imagine what we could be doing if we weren't spending so much of our livelihood on weapons of deadlihood. Imagine think tanks where they think about something other than tanks. Imagine young people living for their country instead of dying for it.
Yeah.
Well, imagine health and education fully funded, and when the Air Force wants a new bomber, they have to run the bake sale to make the money.
That sounds pretty sane to me.
Well, you know, I've been told many times, Swami, you must be crazy to propose anything that's sane.
There you go.
But you know what? Maybe part of the wising up is a rising up to see from a higher perspective than the dueling dualities. Now, if we want a better choice than Saddam Hussein or George who's not sane, it's time for we the people to move past left and right, come front and center, and declare the whole world our sane asylum.
Sane, not insane, but a sane asylum. That's
yes, we point. Have to commit ourselves to this.
That's great. Swami Beyondananda, the Wake Up Rising, wakeuplaughing.com, the website. Swami, I notice some conservatives are now unhappy with government spending, domestic spying, even the war in Iraq. Any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, even the Republicans, even some Republicans are coming to see that there's a difference between protection and the protection racket. And, you know, with DeLay and Abramoff and all those other gold-collar criminals, they're seeing that the family values they thought they were voting for bear an uncanny resemblance to Soprano family values.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I can't pass up an opportunity to ask you about Dick Cheney and shooting this guy now in the heart, it turns out.
Well, you know, I think this should once and for all silence some of Cheney's critics who say that he is a chicken hawk who leaves the shooting to other people.
Yeah. You know, I thought it was, on a perhaps a serious note, Swami, I thought it was ironic that yesterday Cheney was trying to humanize himself with Brit Hume by talking about how he'll never get the image out of his mind out of his memory of watching his friend fall after being shot. When thousands, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, certainly of our soldiers, probably have those same images burned into their minds as a result of Cheney's lies to the American people.
Well, you know, that's part of the irony deficiency that unfortunately too many people still suffer from.
Yeah, clearly.
We have to see the irony in all that.
Yes. As you may have seen this week, a new UN report tells us that we've been torturing prisoners at Guantanamo. New pictures out. Can you shed any light on this?
Well, you know, all of this thing about torture, you have to read the fine print. We don't torture because we no longer call it torturing. There's apparently a more politically correct term. It's called testifying under oath, O-A-F, under oath.
Yeah, geez. You got an oaf sitting on you, you mean?
That's right. Remember, you are under oath, everybody in America.
Yeah. And the oafs are taking over the Department of Homeland Security and the... Oh, my. What do you think about this this thing? Halliburton just got $300 million to build detention camps in the United States.
Well, I think that that's right on target. That should tell people everything they need to know, both about Halliburton and the administration. And, you know, this is the time for us to wake up and wise up.
There you go. WakeUpLaughing.com. Swami Beyondananda. Thank you, Swami, for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, rightrosesociety.org, airamericaradio.com, and also in 29 states in digital television systems and CRN. CRN Digital, Tom Hartman here with you. Cynthia McKinney is with us. She was a Georgia state legislator from 1988 to 1992, elected to the U.S. House of Representatives decisively in 1992, where she represents the 4th Congressional District of Georgia. And she is currently a member of the House Armed Services Committee. The International Relations Committee serves as ranking member on its International Operations and Human Rights Subcommittee. Congresswoman McKinney, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Thank you so much
for asking me to join you.
Well, I have to say thank you so much for being you. My wife and I and our three children lived in Atlanta from 1983 until 1996, I think, and about 13 years. And you were often in the news, and you were constantly writing op-ed pieces, frequently writing op-ed pieces there for the Atlanta Constitution Journal. And I have read many of your words, and I'm a great fan of yours. So although we've never met, I just wanted you to know I think of you as one of the heroes that we have in the United States House of Representatives.
Well, thank you very much. And now let me just say something to you. I just had an encounter on the floor of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And I read your column that you read, that you wrote about Cheney and Rumsfeld having done this in the 1970s,
right,
hyping fear to the American people.
Yep.
Well, I read portions of it on the floor of the House, and the parliamentarian called me out of order.
Why is that?
Well, he said I couldn't say that the vice president lied. Your piece is going to be censored, but it's going to be inserted into the congressional record. But it's going to be censored.
That's amazing.
That's
right. Amazing. I'm astounded. What I wanted to let you know about is that I got a lot of the information that's in that piece from a three-hour documentary that the BBC put together 2 years ago. It's called The Power of Nightmares, and Adam Curtis is the producer of it. There's another article I wrote about this called Hyping Terror for Fun and Profit that has a lot more detail about that particular documentary and the history of the modern Al-Qaeda movement, which actually started with a guy who was part of the Islamic Brotherhood living in St. Louis, and of the history of the modern neocon movement, which started with Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago, about the same time in the early 60s in the United States. They were both looking at what was going on and going, This is the end of civilization, you know. Civil rights are happening, and women have birth control pills, and people are smoking pot, and Elvis Presley is dancing like this, and we can't have this. And it created both the right wing neocons in the United States, and it created what became Al Qaeda. It's an amazing story. So I wanted to turn you on to that.
Well, now let me ask you before you go
sure.
to your question. Can I find that article on your website?
Yes, if you go to tomhartman.com, and any way you spell it will get you there, because we have all the misspellings. And
okay.
in the upper right-hand corner, it says Articles on Democracy, and there's an archive of all the articles that I've written. And if you just scroll down to an article titled Hyping Terror for Fun, Profit, and Power, which I published in December of 2004.
Oh, I see your picture.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, you must be in front of a web browser. That's me. And if you click that upper right hand corner where it says Articles on Democracy, and the top one you'll see, of course, is the one that you were just reading on the floor of the House. Rumsfeld and Cheney revived their 70s terror playbook. But if you scroll down a ways.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm on. Okay, I know you can't take me through it. I'll figure it out. But
well, it's there.
I'm on the radio.
Yeah.
How do I get to the articles?
If you're on you're on my main homepage.
Yes.
Across the very top, there's five little kind of words.
Okay. Very good. I got it.
Far right hand corner, it says Articles on Democracy.
I
just
got
click
it.
Those words, and that'll take you right to the article.
I'm right there now.
Okay, cool. So, and you want to scroll down to an article called Hyping Terror for Fun, Profit, and Power. It's probably a foot or so down, and you could just search on the word hyping. And that article will give you so much ammunition. So what?
Well, then that means I'm going to get called out of order again.
There you go. But then you'll be quoting the BBC rather than just me. because in fact, there's even some talk about the BBC documentary coming to the United States.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
It is one of the things that is bringing down Tony Blair, frankly, is the fact that this three-hour documentary ran back last November. It's called The Power of Nightmares. And the British people were able to see how this thing was put together. And, you know, basically the curtain got pulled back and they could see the wizard was not what they thought.
Yeah. But now, you know, I remember reading an article that suggested that the Carlyle Group was trying to buy the BBC. Did you read anything like that?
I've heard comments to that effect. I've not seen anything solid about it.
Okay.
But I know that there are efforts going on inside the United Kingdom to privatize the BBC, so it wouldn't surprise me if the Carlyle Group's standing in line saying, hey, don't forget about us.
Yeah, we've got a ready supply of dollars.
Yeah, there you go. And they sure do. They sure do.
What just a loss that would be.
Oh, I know. It's just like the Republicans trying to take over public broadcasting in the United States and turn it into Republican public broadcasting. You know,
right. So, exactly. And what happened in Italy with Berlusconi?
Oh, we do Berlusconi alerts on this program. Anytime that Berlusconi does something outrageous, I play O Solo Mio and I tell the story about how this guy, he owns 95% of the media in that country. You know, the radio stations, the television stations, all the radio networks, all the TV networks, most of the newspapers. And then he runs for office and he gets elected. What a surprise.
I know.
That's incredible.
I know.
So what, we only have about 3.5 minutes here before we have to take a break. And,
okay.
And I'm just wondering what provoked you to take this issue to the floor of the House? What are you working on? What's going on right now with you? Cynthia,
well,
we're talking with Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia.
Actually, I was, you know, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and so we had riveting testimony yesterday, which I hope the listeners will tune in to if C-SPAN will replay it, because the C-SPAN cameras were there.
Mm-hmm.
And Congressman Kurt Weldon has been on this Able Danger thing.
Right.
And so we had three witnesses there yesterday who said that if they had been allowed to do their work, that their work could quite possibly have prevented 911, and they all said it. And then they all said that, this was at a different part of the hearing, that the 911 commission report was incomplete because it didn't mention the work that they had done. And so this was in the context of Donald Rumsfeld announcing the Long War. And, you know, I scoured the Internet for articles, and I found your article, and I just thought it was so perfect and perfectly timed for what we are having to deliberate on in Congress right now. So I wanted to read it into the record.
Well, Rumsfeld is essentially suggesting that we have a brand new Cold War, another 50 years of fear. Another 50 years of defense spending beyond the horizon.
But you know what? The thing that makes it so bad is, and this is what I didn't get a chance to talk about today on the floor since I was ruled out of order and got sidetracked, but in one of the hearings that we had, you know, the Pentagon admits that it lost $2.1 trillion in 99 and then another $1.1 trillion that they couldn't track in 2000. So we're talking trillions of dollars in transactions that the Department of Defense can't track. The GAO, Government Accountability Office, just came out. Every year they make a statement that the reason the federal budget can't balance its books is because the Department of Defense is not auditable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked Christina Jonas, who is the comptroller of the Pentagon, what steps they were taking, and they said that, you know, they're trying to get their computers to talk to each other. And I asked her how much money had they spent on getting the computers to talk to each other. Guess how much the Pentagon has spent? $20 billion with a B dollars.
Wow.
Just to get the computers to talk to each other. Now, I don't know about you, but I can think of several smaller computer organizations, experts who would get together for a fraction of that to make the computers talk to each other. But $20 billion, it sounds like a black hole to me, where they're just dumping taxpayers' dollars.
Yeah, it really does. We're talking with Cynthia McKinney, the congresswoman from Georgia, who is on the House Armed Services Committee, a member of the International Relations Committee as well, ranking member of its International Operations and Human Rights Subcommittee.
I got to make a slight change. I'm on the Budget Committee, not the International,
okay.
Even though
okay,
that's
great.
On my website.
Okay, that's on your bio. And
yeah.
Congresswoman McKinney, we have to take a break right now, or in about a half a minute. I'm wondering if you can stick around over the break and we can just wrap this conversation up?
Sure.
If you're available. I'm so grateful to you for coming on the program on such short notice. And
it's my pleasure, especially since I just called your name on the floor of the House.
Thank you. I just also, one of the folks in our chat room just shared with me this BBC News story, UK to float defense firm Quintec. Are you familiar with Quintec?
Yes, Kinetic is the name
Kinetic.
Of the company.
Okay.
And it's a... Well, we'll talk after the break.
We'll have to talk after the break. Yeah,
yeah.
When the machine starts the music, I've got to stop too. So we're talking
okay.
with Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, if you'd like to say hi to her. We'll have a few minutes when we come back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And there's always somebody who says what the others just whisper. And mostly that someone's the first one to get shot down dead. So when you talk to a cowboy, don't treat him like he was a sister. You came with a lady that's sleeping in each cowboy's head. Cowboys are frequently secretly fond of each other.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. That Willie Nelson's new song about gay cowboys. Fascinating, fascinating piece of music. We're speaking with Cynthia McKinney, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of the 4th District of Georgia. And Congresswoman McKinney, some of our listeners have some questions for you. Do you mind taking a couple calls? Are you still there with us? Cynthia McKinney? I think she should be there. Hello? Nope, we've lost her. Oh, well. Apparently she has vanished. Welcome back to our program. I'll take some calls here. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I was really encouraged to hear you on with an elected official that you actually could get straight answers from and talk like a real human being.
Yeah, she's a good person.
Yeah. My question is who decided to change the standard when the executive wants to make significant changes in our governmental structures or constitutional structures? The standard used to be, you know, the Congress would say, well, prove to us how this is not going to make the American people more vulnerable to suppression by their government. Now the standard seems to be, you know, the executive saying, well, prove that I have ill intent in doing this. Otherwise, I get to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Patriot Act. And,
right. And yeah, it's kind of flipped around to the you're guilty until you prove that you're innocent.
Yeah. Or more importantly is I get to act on this unless you can prove that I have, you know, bad intent in wanting to make these changes.
Yeah.
You know, rather than something inherently having the potential to be damaging to our freedoms, The executive seems to have the, you know, the standard seems to have shifted to where it's, you know, we have to prove that they actually intend to do something wrong before we can stop them from doing it.
That's very strange. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Jerry. And well said. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Sherwin in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Sherwin.
Hello. I really love your radio show. It's really great. Yeah, I love this radio station. It's really refreshing to hear something besides the Nazi neoconservative rhetoric that we hear all the time from you know where.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Talk 1090 in Seattle does a great job.
Yeah, it's great. I wanted to know, what do you think? Do you think that Cheney will have to resign as a result of his latest faux pas?
You mean the shooting this guy?
Yeah, the incident.
No, I don't think so. I think the shooting the guy thing is going to blow over, and Cheney, there was no breathalyzer test. There's going to be a lot of lingering questions, but no, I don't think he's going to resign as a result of that. I think, you know, the greater possibility, and this is what Cheney is behind the scenes working very, very hard to prevent, is that the Republicans in the United States Senate will investigate either the CIA comment, this comment from this guy, Paul Pillar, that the CIA was looking into, that the CIA had told Cheney, there's no there with regard to Saddam and 9/11. And Cheney was telling us, telling Congress, and Cheney's people telling the world the exact opposite. Number one, he was lying to us. Or that Cheney was releasing classified information through Scooter Libby. I think those things are more likely to come back and bite him. And we saw the beginning of the framing of that yesterday in Cheney's conversation with Brit Hume, where Brit Hume said, well, you know, people are upset about your releasing this information. And, well, in fact, here, let me just play this thing for you.
Court filings have indicated that Scooter Libby has suggested that his superiors, unidentified, authorized the release of some classified information. What do you know about that?
There's nothing I can talk about, Brent. This is an issue that's been under investigation for a couple of years. I've cooperated fully, including being interviewed as well by a special prosecutor. All of it's now going to trial. Scooter's entitled to the presumption of innocence. He's a great guy. I've worked with him for a long time. I have enormous regard for him. I may well be called as a witness at some point in the case, and it's therefore inappropriate for me to comment on any facet of the case.
However,
another question. Is it your view that a vice president has the authority to declassify information?
There's an executive order to that effect.
There is?
Yeah.
Have you done it?
Well, I've certainly advocated declassification and participated in declassification decisions.
Have you ever done it unilaterally?
I don't want to get into that.
So here we go from the Scooter Libby thing. So Brit Hume has his talking points. He's got Cheney's talking points, and he's feeding them to him. And he says, can you declassify information? And I'm telling you, this is going to be Cheney's defense when Cheney comes before when this comes before him, when Cheney is facing the possibility of impeachment. Oh, that information that Scooter Libby released, that Scooter Libby is willing to testify, you know, he's willing to turn on me. That information that Scooter Libby released, I declassified that. This is going to be sort of like Nixon's defense. If the president does it, it must be legal. You'll recall, you know, Nixon's famous remark.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
And what Cheney is going to say is, well, when the vice president says it, and says it to his chief of staff, and his chief of staff then says it to a newspaper, it's now declassified. So I didn't release any classified information. He's already set up his defense. It's coming down the road. You're going to see it happen. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Aaron Brooks says there should be no more smoking bans. Jeffrey Klein will be telling us what to look for at the movies. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where we recommend not bagging Republicans like Cheney did. They're just too hard to clean. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.